Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you a special presentation of Herculean Physique. It's called Wrestling with Yetus, and it's about some thoughts on getting older. Although the tale does not survive, Hercules' encounter with Yetus, known to us as old age, is preserved on ancient pottery. Yetus was said to be a child of Erebos and Nyx, the primordial goddess of night, or sometimes the issue of Nyx alone. As can be expected, in some depictions, our hero is engaged in staving off or actively fighting old age. The shriveled and diminutive Yetus doesn't seem to stand a chance. In other depictions, the encounter between Hercules and Yetus seems remarkably free of conflict, almost friendly. How do we reconcile these contradictory images? Perhaps there are different points in a greater tale. Perhaps they depict different incidents altogether. Alas, we may never know. Now that I'm in my 60s, with at least half my life behind me, I'd like to venture a guess. At my age, the impulse to mitigate the effects of aging, which can no longer be ignored, is quite strong. Exercise, supplementation, and diet are recruited, and a variety of cosmetic, emotional, mental, and spiritual techniques are gradually added to our arsenal of weapons until Yetus is kept at bay. Sometimes the fight is hard, with drugs, surgery, and fringe or cutting-edge science. Though the struggle, acceptance eventually emerges, and with it, peace. Embracing old age and facing the finality of all mortal life allows you to appreciate the preciousness of each and every passing moment. When I personally found myself there, I made a vow. Until I die, I resolve to fully live. Onwards. And tonight, I'm going to be conversing with my good friend Michael Del Russi, and we'll be sharing our thoughts on getting older and staying younger. Greetings, Michael. How are you?
Great to be with you. And that introduction really tells the whole story of our journey through mortality, if you will, and to trying to make it the best we possibly can. I think for the most part, I think only as we get older do we realize the calling of this journey and how exciting it can be if we decide to really make a fight of it from every possible source that we can and utilizing every technique that we can. Some days when I'm not feeling altogether well, I remind myself that that is my calling, and by the gods, I'm going to make a fight of it, and no matter what the results may be. So your introduction certainly covers all of that territory.
Well, thank you, and I'm engaged in the same struggle, and I've certainly learned a lot from you, and I'm looking forward to learning more from you as we discuss the particulars of our journeys and all of the things we attempt, and all the things that seem to work, all the things that seem not to, and to look forward forever into the future.
Well, I'd like to get started, if I can, with some of the latest studies that I've come across. My source mostly is the Life Extension Foundation. Every month, they send me a journal with a wide variety of research and the latest studies from a variety of areas. So I'd like to start out with one that recently came across my desk, and it is that more vitamin K intake is linked to reduction of diabetes.
Oh, wow.
Individuals with a high intake of vitamin K were found to have lower blood glucose and less insulin resistance, as well as a reduced risk of developing type 2 diabetes, according to a systemic review and meta-analysis. By the way, what a meta-analysis really means is just from many different sources. That's basically the definition of meta-analysis, which I think is important. Meta-analysis of 5 observational studies examined the association between reported daily vitamin K intake and the development of type 2 diabetes among 105,798 participants. The researchers found a 21% lower risk of developing diabetes among those whose vitamin K intake was highest compared with those whose was in the lowest. Meta-analysis of 7 controlled trials compared the effects of treatment with vitamin K1 or K2 to a placebo or a multivitamin formula that did not contain vitamin K. The decline in glucose from levels measured at the beginning of the trials was significantly greater at the end of the trials among diabetics who received vitamin K in comparison with those who did not. I think that's a very important study. I think all of us, even those of us who at least at this time are dealing with normal blood sugar levels, should think about, take this report very seriously and consider including vitamin K2 certainly in their diet, along with vitamin D3. I myself have been a little bit neglectful of my vitamin D3 intake lately, and realizing that, especially with the severe arthritis I'm dealing with in both shoulders, I've decided to uptake my vitamin D3 and try to combat this challenger, if it were. So I thought that was a very interesting and powerful study.
Yes, the next study I'm going to follow my D3 also. I have a prescription for it, so I'm supposed to take it once a week. But because it's only once a week, I wind up forgetting it, and then I'll remember like Tuesday or Wednesday. So I'll have to take it then and then take some lower dosage vitamin D3 to kind of fill up the gap.
Now, share with me this. You, in other words, this is a prescription you
yes.
receive from your physician.
Yes.
Okay, so it must be a higher amount of D3.
Significantly, yes, and it's pharmaceutical grade D3 as well.
Okay, well, that's a good thing. That's a good thing. Yes, well, I think adding vitamin K2 would be a benefit, certainly. A 1-2 punch, if you will, to dealing with some of the, not only blood sugar levels, but the other challenges that vitamin D seems to attack with significance. So, yes, I think that's a good idea, certainly. The next study I'd like to share is thiamine, vitamin B1, may improve heart attack survival rates. Heart attack patients admitted to an intensive care unit frequently suffer from thiamine deficiency. Those given thiamine, vitamin B1, had a lower risk of dying in the hospital, as well as a lower mortality risk after 30 and 90 days, retrospectively. The study included 1,782 men and women who were admitted to an intensive care unit for a heart attack for at least 48 hours. 170 patients were given thiamine, while the other 1,612 were not. Patients who were given thiamine had a 39.5% lower adjusted risk of in-hospital mortality than those who did not receive the vitamin. The thiamine group also had a 30-day adjusted mortality risk that was 38.2% lower, and a 90-day mortality risk that was 37.4% lower than those who did not receive the vitamin. This is another place that while I do take a multivitamin powder, I may have been a little lax in my B-complex vitamins. I'd like to know what your journey is on this, but I take so many supplements at this point, more than I ever have in my life.
And me too, and it's become difficult to gauge the effectiveness. I've always like cycled through vitamins, like I'll take them for a while, then I'll stop. And some things I decide to continue with without checking out whether it works. Like, for instance, Ocuvite, the 50-plus type, because I'm over. They help with my eyes. If I stop taking the Ocuvites within a few days, I'll notice a very big difference in my ability to see. So that I stopped testing. And then there are some other vitamins that I can't tell the difference between when I take them and when I don't take them. So those I let go for longer before I take them again. But I have so many vitamins, so I can't possibly take all these vitamins during the course of the day. So I go down the vitamin list, and sometimes within 3 days I'll get to all of them, because there's so many, and that can't be healthy either, taking like dozens of vitamins every day.
Well, I agree with you. I think when you take it, but I think the more research we do on the concentrated levels of these various nutrients and phytonutrients, fibers, and what have you, and the more positive research that we come that we become familiar with, frankly, from my perspective, you, especially as we get older, you can't help but get excited at what's at the potential of what some of these nutrients can do. Two of that I've become very interested in. One I'm on a never-ending campaign for is IP6, inositol hexylphosphate. I continue to campaign. I continue to inform everyone, including doctors. I recently had a long conversation with my gastroenterologist, and after having two diagnostic procedures, I wanted to talk to him about it, get his opinion on it, especially when we're living in an age, and I think I discussed this some of our previous podcasts. In fact, going as far back as last year, we were discussing the rise in colon cancer patients amongst the young. And we were discussing the mystery of all of this. And according to some of the reports I've read, gastroenterologists have been shaking their heads. They don't really know. And I speculated on the possibility that this high-fat wave that we're experiencing, this trend, if you will, that fat overall is no longer a problem in the American diet, that it's mostly processed sugars, processed foods, and sugar that is the main problem with diabetes. And heart disease. So I asked my gastroenterologist, who's a very young, aggressive man, but been in the field quite a while, what do you think, doctor? Report after report, the research is just never ending in terms of the possibility of IP6, and yet I don't hear any conventional doctors speaking about it. The holistic community seems laissez-faire about it if they mention it at all. And what do you think? So he was doing his research as I was speaking to him. He was going, I could see he was interested. I could see he was curious. He said, you're absolutely right. He said that there seems to be nothing but positive reports and meta studies concerning IP6 and a whole variety of metastatic diseases, along with, by the way, the added potential of lowering blood sugar, lowering lipids in the body, and lowering cholesterol is two of the added benefits. The third benefit, which I'm interested in as well, because I was told that I have a few calcium deposits in my pancreas, which certainly, this was last year. While they said there was no sign of any metastatic disease, I have a few punctate meaning round, calcium deposits in my pancreas. So my doctor asked me, Michael, do you drink? I said, well, in my youth, I certainly, I did my share. I wouldn't say I had a drinking problem. In my later adult years, I would start the day with my supper, because I worked at nights, with a couple of glasses of red wine.
Uh-huh.
And I, while consuming red wine, all I thought of was the benefits. I didn't stop to think, wait a minute, no matter what type of alcohol you're drinking, even the wonderful euphoric feeling that red wine can donate, if you will, alcohol as a whole is inflammatory, as a whole,
right.
Finding out that. And studies out of, I don't know if it was Finland, it may have been, but that indicated, or I think it might have been the UK as well, that even one drink, just one drink, can contribute to a higher rate, a higher susceptibility to cancer, just having one drink. I know that.
Wow.
That's tough to swallow for most of us, because at one time or another, we all would like to have a glass of red wine or a beer, possibly, you know, part of living, throughout history, regardless of what culture you come from. So anyway, that concerns me a little bit. My doctor suggested, he said, take digestive enzymes, which I already do. He said, well, take plenty of digestive enzymes. So I'll be going for a follow-up scan just to make sure that it is nothing more than a few calcium deposits. But whenever you get news like that, of course, at first it can shake you up a little bit.
Oh, but, of course.
Yeah, so that's another area. And I always tell people, and I told a friend of mine, I said, look, think about this. As much as I have done most of my life, and I'm not saying as parts of my life I didn't live a bit recklessly, because I guess you could say I did. As compared to most in my circles, I was very tame.
Right.
I was very tame, you know, but still it doesn't matter. People who've never taken an alcoholic drink develop pancreatic cancer.
Yes.
So, you know, and of course we know that smoking is a major factor. The point I wanted to drive home to my associate was that, you know, do the best you can. Make a real fight of holding on to your good health. And if you're dealing with a specific illness of any kind, fight like the devil. First, hopefully, with non-toxic natural therapies that seem to work. And secondly, if you have to and you think your body can withstand the journey, then by all means, you choose a conventional treatment, which is most appropriate. The thing that always it leaves me stunned, and somebody mentioned this to me the other day, is that virtually no matter what pharmaceutical you see advertised on television, and we can go on and on about it, can cause essentially very serious diseases, whether
right.
it be lymphoma or certain types of cancers or arthritis, or there's a risk of dementia. If you're taking a drug for psoriatic psoriasis, there's a risk of dementia. There's a risk of certain types of cancers. And I have to say to myself, what exactly is going on here? I mean, if these drugs can help you with a specific condition, why must they carry along with them such profound after effects that can literally kill you before the condition does? And yet here they are, approved by the FDA and available to all of us. And you have to ask the question, no matter what side of the fence you're on, is if this was a natural substance, a natural vitamin, phytonutrient, mineral, whatever the case might be, if this caused even one of these serious side effects, you'd see it on the front page. The FDA intends on banning so-and-so. I say, there's something wrong here. If you apply holistic mind, if you apply logical mind with creative spiritual mind, if you work in unison in terms of how your mind is thinking and working, it doesn't make sense. It does not make sense. These drugs should be put through trials where the side effects are very, very minimal. This, I think any of us with any level of common sense would have to ask that question. If the drug can kill me, has a good chance of killing me before my disease does, theoretically speaking, what is the point? What is the point? And
That's true. I was prescribed a new drug for my diabetes, mm-hmm. and I took it, I wasn't feeling well after a couple of days. I was feeling a lot worse than normal. And so I started researching it. And I'd come down with all these weird symptoms, including my voice going from rough to soft. And, mm-hmm. So I looked. I had every single rare symptom. And the only one I didn't have was sudden death. So I stopped taking the pills. And I told my doctor, it's like, well, you should give him a chance. I said, no, not when I'm getting all the rare symptoms except for sudden death. I'm not going to,
You're not going to wait for that.
No. And she was saying that I need it, and it's like, but look at all these symptoms I got, and it's supposed to be rare. I want to kill myself on the process of getting well, like you're stating.
Yeah. You know, there's a dark humor here somewhere. You know,
somewhere.
Some ways, yes, there's a dark humor here, but or an irony, and it's certainly there's nothing funny about it, but it just leaves you speechless. Because, and this is wide ranging. This issue you're discussing is wide ranging. Is this a drug you recently have been taking, or was this a while ago?
This was less than half a year ago, and mm-hmm. I just took it. I took it for less than a week because I developed all these weird symptoms. So I wasn't about to give it a chance. So I said I'm not taking this. I told my pharmacist too that. To check if anything else that I'm prescribed had any of this stuff in it, because I reacted very poorly to it.
Yeah. Well, by all means, that's why it's so important, again, that we be our own champions when fighting the warrior of old age, if you will. And I'm certainly pleased that you questioned your doctor on this and didn't take yes for an answer, if you will. Another issue you may have seen on TV that... And I warned a friend about this, wasn't diabetic, but was considering taking Ozempic, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, Ozempic, for weight loss and for diabetes. And mostly for diabetes, but it also, the advertisement's very clear, it can also help you lose weight. Now we're finding out, I believe this started last week, this information was revealed last week, that it may cause some other serious side effects, like arthritic conditions, dementia has been mentioned now, where it comes to Ozempic, and they're warning everyone about this drug. And I had a friend. There are individuals out there always looking for shortcuts.
Right.
Well, you know, in turn, as opposed to diet, exercise, and making lifestyle changes, there's always somebody out there. And I have someone in my life now that consistently, while they go to the gym, and they're always looking for a shortcut of some kind. And now I said, look, the original intent for this drug was to reduce blood sugar, but a side benefit. Was that you may, and this is what the commercial says, you may lose weight. Well, you may lose weight, but then you also may be affecting the brain, the bones, certain other issues, where now they're warning against it. You take it only for what it's intended for, and even then you have to be aware there may be serious side effects. So here we are again. Something that seemed like, all right, maybe a miracle pill in terms of dieting and weight loss. And now we have to be cautious. It can affect the brain. It can affect the bones, create an arthritic condition. So another example of, you know, we're calling this progress, and on some level, maybe it is. But an awful risk with these pharmaceuticals. So my feeling is that if it's an immediate crisis, by all means, if you need an antibiotic, an antiviral medication, in the immediate, absolutely. You have to, you cannot eliminate conventional medicine. But in the meantime, by all means, do your research. Do your research. Once the immediate condition hopefully has passed, now think about stimulating your immune response, strengthening your immune system, strengthening the production of T cells and B cells. I think there'll come a day. I certainly don't believe I'm going to live to see it. But as I've mentioned in prior programs, where your physician will give you a list, a chart, a printout, if you will. All right, now stimulate your immune response while we're dealing with this crisis. But once your conventional treatment has concluded, stimulate your immune response. Get your endocrine system back to a healthy environment. I pray someday that this will be a normal protocol for all of our conventional treatment, if you will, from our primary care physician, first and foremost, and others. I'm obviously a small voice in the sea, but hopefully some of these concepts, which this is what this is all about. This is what we do. This is what we do. This is what you do. This is what I do. This is what your other guests do. Research. Research into the cutting-edge natural therapies that can work, that will be very valuable to the individual if they do work, with minimal or zero, in most cases, zero side effects. That's the future of longevity and wrestling with Gyros, as you've so beautifully described in the opening of your program. This is what it's all about, because nature has given us these medicines. Nature has given them to us.
There's also the challenge of what if your body is doing something too effectively? Like, for instance, the type of diabetes that I have is my immune system is overworking itself. Mm-hmm. So it's overreacting. So it's reacting, but it's reacting too often and too much to blood sugar problems. So sometimes it's not just stimulating the immune system. It's getting the immune system to take a break or, you know, like wait before reacting.
Right, modulating itself. A question and then a statement, if I may.
Sure.
Are you type two diabetic?
Type two diabetes, yes.
Okay, and one number two. How were you informed, and what did they do to determine that your immune system is overworking?
It was some of the research at the beginning that I was doing, and I was talking to dietitians and all sorts of other people, and what seemed to be happening, what was the consensus at that time over a decade ago, was that my immune response was too sensitive, and that's why I was having some of the problems that I was having.
The reason I asked that, too, is one of the reasons for that may be because we know that sugar in itself, pure glucose or something similar to it, can cause inflammation.
Yes.
So obviously, if our body is not accepting insulin the way it should, glucose the way it should, is not producing the proper amount of insulin, there's going to be inflammation there. So my thinking is, if that's the case, what to utilize supplements that we know can reduce systemic inflammation. Inflammation, as we know, is not altogether a terrible thing. And the immediate, well, if you suffer a cut on your finger, or as an example, the body, reacts to it with an immune response. But if the immune response is long-term, then it's coined chronic inflammation, and that's where other problems can arise. So, that's the other side of that. So I could see where, that's a real possibility. So you might want to, I think that overall, and we can discuss this further down the road, where I think fish oil would be somewhat, and melatonin would be very effective in calming chronic inflammation. There's been so much, as well as ginger and some of these aloe vera and some of these other soothing nutrients may contribute to combating that problem. So it's interesting that you could share that with us. And thank you for that, because that certainly is enlightening.
I find that it's like the maze of Daedalus or like the Hydra that Hercules fought. There's so many different heads. Once you think you've addressed one head, two more pop up in its place, and you have to deal with that. I've been experimenting, as you know, with meditation for very many years, and with visualization and affirmations. And again, I don't know how much good they're doing, but I do know that I feel better when I consistently do them than if I neglect to do them, even for a few days. And how I process stress, that seems to be affected by how much I meditate. And the meditation isn't difficult. I just basically focus on my breathing. I don't really chant mantras. Sometimes I repeat affirmations. I'll repeat the same phrase over and over again. And I'll visualize, you know, I'll see myself I'm healed and feeling fantastic. Again, like with the lutein with my eyes, I just notice its effectiveness when I stop taking it. So the meditation, if I stop for a couple of days for whatever reason, I feel all sorts of negative energies and outlooks and so forth. So I know that even though it doesn't feel like I'm doing anything when I'm doing it, I definitely will feel the results of not doing it.
What time of the day do you usually choose to meditate? Does it depend on your scheduling, your any specific day, or have you chosen a specific time of day for your meditation practices?
Yes, usually when I'm getting up in the morning and when I'm going to bed at night. So this way my day hasn't started or my day is done, and I'm going to go to sleep anyway, or I'm going to get up anyway, so I'm already relaxing in bed. And then what I do is I breathe slowly, but deeply, and then I start relaxing from my toes to the top of my head, and then I keep doing until I'm in like an altered state of mind, when I'm in alpha state of mind, which is more relaxed. Then I stay there for as long as I can. I do affirmations, visualizations, and use my imagination sometimes. That's also an interesting time to do dream work, which I do. It's called the hypnagogic if you're going to sleep, or the hypnopompic when you're waking up. And that's the state of mind where religious experiences take place fairly often. So
that's true.
I kind of swim in that sea for 10, 15, 20 minutes in the morning and then in the evening. Rarely, but occasionally, I will meditate in the middle of the day if I don't have anything scheduled or requiring my attention. I'll give myself a little oasis of relaxation at that time.
I'm glad you shared that with us. I recently started, along with my prayer and affirmation work, which I do daily, I've also been experimenting with my own body in terms of meditation and taking in white light. But I've done for many years. In fact, the meditation, the technique I use, I learned from Astara. You remember, I know you're familiar with Astara.
Yes, I remember Astara. I might still have some of the booklets from that, the mystery school somewhere.
I enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it. Of course, they garnered their techniques from a variety of different sources, mostly Eastern spiritual practices. But the one meditation I learned from them was white light meditation, where you open your palms, you relax, and you imagine a white light coming through the top of your head and flooding your body as slowly, methodically, and at the same time opening up the third eye. And then while you're doing that, you say to yourself silently, or you can verbalize them, whatever affirmations may seem appropriate. I started experimenting with this technique again about 3 weeks ago. Haven't done it for a while. And I know I focus on my shoulders. I focused on the white light flooding both my shoulders, really. And I'm whispering, healed. My shoulders are healed. My shoulders are normal. The cartilage in my shoulders is healthy. And I've done it 3 times now, and I can honestly testify that the 3 times that I've done it, the pain disappeared for, I would say, 2-3 hours. No pain at all. Completely gone. Because I can say every day, even as I speak to you now, there's some degree of pain in both shoulders. When I do my white light meditation, I can honestly say to you that pain completely disappears after visualizing this white light technique.
Oh, wow.
So completely disappears. And there's obviously validity to it. There's obviously validity. And when I think of the times in my life that I dismissed most of this, in fact, I laughed at it. I just, being an existentialist, I guess, throughout the 80s, and look at all of the progress, spiritual progress I've missed, I didn't really take it serious. I had a voice teacher who was in Montclair. She was also a metaphysician. would tell me about it, talk to me about it. I would listen, but I never took it serious. My favorite music was from Jim Morrison and The Doors, which gives you an idea of just how essential I was. You know, I was in that mode. I said, this is who I am, with a can of beer in one hand and Jim Morrison singing on the stereo. I mean, that's where I was at that point in my life. You know, it was right after my divorce, and I had really no prayer life. So it's taken, 30 years since that time, about 30 years, for me to progress and realize now how real the invisible world is, how faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things unseen, as we know is a biblical scripture. It's so very true. We know that thoughts are things. Thoughts have energy. And secondly, that the intention of our thoughts, the quality of our thoughts matter. Now we know it's very real. It's very real, and it can benefit us. So I'm glad you told that story, because I have experienced similar healing events just from my own practice up to this point. So there's no question that, who knows, personally, from how much time I have wasted by not having some kind of meditative healing practice. Of course, from my viewpoint, my prayer work is mostly from the Judeo-Christian area, but it doesn't matter. The infinite
I don't think it matters
infinite.
Either.
Right. You know, the infinite is infinite. It's in and around all things. And no matter how you connect with the infinite, you know, acknowledging that it's a part of us and it's all around us, that's what really matters. So I really like that you touched upon that area of knowledge, because it's really essential to us. And even those of us who are believers and we know that the invisible world is part of who we are and part of our daily lives, acknowledging it is so very important, whether it be through meditation, prayer, affirmations, whatever the case might be.
What you call the white light meditation, which I forgot was also in Astaru, is something I use in my Merkaba meditations.
Mm-hmm.
The ancients had a UFO tradition. They didn't call it UFOs, but it was quite an extensive body of knowledge. And if you're an obscure scholar, you'll know where to find it. It's in print. It's been the exploration or the sandbox of scholars, but it's not really generally known in the public. But there are a lot of practices about traveling to other worlds through astral projection, through lucid dreaming, through removing your mind from your body and moving it through, you know, different spaces. I'm going to be teaching more classes locally, and that's one of the classes I'll be teaching. But the white light meditation you described with the ball of light and going in through your head and so forth, that's one of the steps in getting the two rotating triangles or tetrahedrons or pyramids that make up for the Merkaba.
I see. Will you be teaching this in person, or will you be teaching this on the podcast?
A little of both. I've been talking with some of my hosts, and I was going to talk to you also about starting a online school so that people can actually learn more personally from our personal explorations. And I was thinking of talking about it on the podcast, you know, endlessly through many shows. I already started that with the Hercules and the Space Gods umbrella. But I also want to teach it. And so I am going to be doing it locally through my Theosophia esoteric studies group that meets once a month in person and once a month on Zoom. So then I'm going to do it through the school as well. We're calling the school the Athenaeum. After Athena in antiquity, Athenaeums were a combination between a school, a library, and a museum. If you rolled all those into one thing, it would be an Athenaeum.
Well, I would be excited to hear that program and also to participate in it, because I think all of your guests would have a lot, including yourself, obviously, would have a lot to share in this area. And I would be excited to see you know, what else can I learn from
and what else
you?
Michael, you're a pioneer spiritual as well. You know, you'll take the road less traveled as well as traveling the traveled road. And you find a lot of things through your explorations. And you're one of the few people I've met who genuinely understands, not just intellectually, that the path that you take to the inner world or to the heaven worlds is it doesn't have to be the same as everybody else's. That as long as it starts you from point A and brings you to point B, I most of it was silly. It's like saying, I want to get to New York, and everybody wants to get to New York. How can you get to New York? You can walk to New York, you can take a taxi, you can take a bus, you can take a series of buses, or you can be driven to a bus stop and take a bus. You can walk to New York. Those are all ways of walking to New York. And New York is a vast place. So depending on where and when you go to New York, you'll have a totally different experience of New York. You know, it might be a great experience, it might be a horrific experience, it might be just a neutral, boring experience, but there's so many different variables. And people beat themselves up and kill themselves over which way they got to New York or which version of New York they experienced and which is the real one. As we know, a place like New York can be very contradictory in the things that you experience there. And so you learn that the path isn't what the problem is. It's understanding the destination and being flexible enough to allow others' interpretations of the destination to be there, part of the dialogue that you learn from.
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think this is one area amongst others that we're brothers in this area, because while I, in my extensive prayer work, becoming more and more extensive because I have a prayer list now, I pray in a Judeo-Christian method I use. But I, having said that, I am fully aware that whether we want to face it or not, the denominational dogma, if you will, has done more damage to more people and more populations, more than anything we could possibly imagine. And I think when you get to the point when you can walk into any temple, including your own private home or sitting in your car, and simply close your eyes and acknowledge the infinite, and then let that take you where your own personal spirit tells you. I think the only prerequisite, the only thing I absolutely believe that shouldn't be left out is whatever path you take, whether it's your pagan practices or your Christian practices or Jewish spirituality, which can be somewhat complicated down the road with the Tree of Life and what have you, whatever the case might be, I think the only mandate is to acknowledge that there is a greater source out there that we are connected to. There is a creative mind. There's a creative something that we are connected. The very fact that we have the ability to contemplate our own mortality indicates consciousness. That indicates consciousness. And you have to ask yourself, where did that come from? How did I, as a mortal human, how did I develop that? Why is that inside me? Why do I even ask that question? It has to lead me to the possibility there is one divine cosmic force out there that somehow we are connected to. I do agree biblically when Jesus said, I am the vine and you are the branches, speaking paradoxically, if you will, in some areas. I understand that concept, and I think that's probably true of all of us. So I think the only thing I personally would not want to participate in is when I'm practicing my law of attraction or the law of manifestation, and which I believe is absolute science to back that up, is that I always make sure I acknowledge the infinite. Mm-hmm. I have to do that because I know that it's not just me. I'm connected in the invisible world. I'm connected to something. So for me, that's the only mandate in my spiritual work. But I agree with you. Beyond that, there's many paths to this infinite consciousness that we're discussing. There's many paths, there's many spirits, there's many personalities. And I respect everybody who's taking that path, whether it be long, short, somewhere in between. If they somehow feel like they're connected with the infinite consciousness, you know, my ears are open to anything they want to share. But I think that for me, that's where it lies. And that's where I think new thought spirituality really hits the target. Because new thoughts, first and foremost, indicates that the universe is mental and we are connected to this divine source, this infinite intelligence, in whatever way. And how we go from there, quite frankly, is our business. It's our business. There are no specific rules, dogma, practices, regulations that we have to adhere to. That's basically what New Thought teaches. And I tip my hat to all of the great New Thought thinkers in early America specifically who taught this. The infinite is in and around us now, and I want to share some examples of that.
Sure.
Through my own New Thought metaphysics at some future date. Because if you see God that way, I shared this once with a Jewish individual, and she said to me, you know, thinking that way is so freeing. It frees you. It's freeing. I said, yes, it does. Yes, it does. As long as we acknowledge that whatever this infinite source is, it's in and around not only us as conscious mortals, but everything around us. It's really just that alone sense chills up my spine when I think of, well, we have the atomic structure to turn to. That's the foundation of our housing. Who created that? Where did that come from? Where did the subatomic universe come from? This subatomic universe that is in everything we experience. Where did that come from? There has to be the cement that everything we experience in our mortal lives and at the next stage as well. So that's what you think, just that alone, if you consider just that fact alone, for me, it sends chills up my spine. I don't need any religious dogma or tell me about any symbolism or practices that I have to adhere to. I can if I want to, but there is the infinite intelligence. Right now as we speak, we're part of that infinite intelligence. And not only that, we're also expressions of it. We are expressing infinite intelligence. Now, our emotions may sabotage us. And, you know, a lot of times when you talk about the law of attraction, why didn't this work? I've said it myself in the past. I don't know, law of attraction. Well, I hear people say it worked. A lot of people say they've tried it, that it doesn't work. Well, you know what? Because many times our emotions sabotage us. That doesn't mean we're committing any terrible sin. It's part of our nature. Our emotions on any given day may sabotage us. But then we step back, we regroup. We realize the power in you and what our potentials might be. You know, so we know even in medicine it's worked. Even with some serious diseases it has worked. The placebo effect, some miraculous healings, you know. And that's why in the Christian community, which in many ways is the ultimate joke, and the reason why I say so many people are disgusted with the Christian community right now, is they're constantly at war. Well, the word of faith no longer exists. Miracles, signs, and wonders, that cannot be. That ended with the apostolic age. That ended with the apostles. That was just an example. What nonsense. Jesus said, I am the Alpha and the Omega. And countless statements. Jesus taught so much. If you look at, there's a book out there. In fact, I have a copy coming. Two copies, as a matter of fact, which I'll tell you about later off the air or next time we speak, where Jesus, name of the book, is Jesus taught it too. I don't think anybody in ancient history taught the law of manifestation or that thoughts can move matter the way Christ did. And we know in Greek, Christ is, the meaning, the definition of Christ is the anointed one. And
that's
there
one.
We are again.
Here I will add something. That's one of the definitions. I had this conversation with one of my hosts a few days, well, not on the air, but the word Christ at the time when the word was being used to spread Christianity could mean three different things, depending on how you spelled it. So if you spell Christos with an EI or an epsilon yota to make the E sound in Christos, it meant an oracle or a fortune teller, somebody who was connected with the divine and was speaking for the divine. If you spelled it with Ita, which looks like an H kind of, and for that represents the E sound, it was like being a Mason or a Rotarian or a Lion, you know, belonging to one of these community organizations and doing good for your community. And then if you spelled it with a yota, which is an like it looks like an I to make the E sound, then Christos meant what do you call it, like an anointed one, like it's used.
the anointed one, yes. Now, most all of that, people, I believe, that comes from the Greek, doesn't it?
Yes.
Most of those.
It's a Greek word. So Christos meant different things, like the word angel. A lot of people say angels were like a separate race of celestial beings. Angel just meant messenger, nothing else. So if I if I mailed you something to tell you about a new Conan comic, or you mailed me something to tell me about a new vitamin, you're an angel, period. Nothing metaphysical about it.
Well, that'll certainly educate some of us too. You know, we all, everybody has been led one way or another to have various, multiple concepts of what an angel actually is. That's interesting. That's an interesting, I did not know a lot of what you just shared with me. That's certainly interesting information where angelic beings are concerned.
And I'll
people,
share
you know,
some very quick English thing. We know the word noble and gentle, and we agree that it's good to be noble and gentle, or to strive to be, right? Noble comes from the concept of nobility, and gentle comes from the concept of a landed gentry. So if somebody owned land, whether they were good, bad, they could be a psycho killer or whatever, they would be gentle. So you could have Hannibal Lecter be gentle if he owned land. He'd be considered gentle. And if he had a royal title, he'd be a noble, regardless of how nobly, by our definition, he acted. The word demon comes from the Greek daemon, D-A-I-M-O-N. And Socrates' highest self was his daemon, if you read about Socrates in Plato. And all it meant was an in-between being. So if anything was between heaven and earth, or earth and the underworld, it was an in-between creature. Whether it was good or bad, it would be a daemon. And then in the early centuries of our era, the word came to be demon, and everything was bad. To the ancients, it was kakodemon and agathodemon. Kakodemon meant bad demon, and agathodemon meant innocent demon. The word demon itself didn't mean back then what it means now, and that confuses a lot of people and leads them astray if they're reading ancient literature.
It certainly does. You've really clarified that. I didn't know that. I had no grasp of the information you just shared, but it opens my eyes in terms of, again, because unfortunately, you know, we carry a lot of our cultural influences with us. And I came from a typical Catholic Italian family, and I knew nothing of metaphysics back when I was growing up. I was reading bodybuilding magazines and buying bodybuilding magazines with my church money. So, you know, this is what's so great about what we do. The research that you have done that you can share with others and enlighten us, myself, all of your other guests, it causes such an expansion in consciousness that, frankly, where else can you get this kind of knowledge, this kind of expansion of mind, if you will, but with projects like this, what you're doing and what others may be doing, similar to ours. Where can you get knowledge like this? It's so exciting. So thank you for sharing all of that.
Well, thank you for sharing everything that you've shared. And you publish your work, your poetry, your research into a lot of different health-related matters, and on your experiments with the white light. How can people find these things and tap into them?
Well, I have a prayer system based on New Thought Spirituality, acknowledging that there's an infinite source that we can express through our daily lives, our activities, our thoughts, that will not only improve our lives, but I will believe in an intercessory concept through prayer and other techniques, improve the lives of others. So my book of poetry is, I think, is really, I will say humbly, is really expansive in itself. There's so many poetic influences there in there that deal with the metaphysical, the invisible world, the paranormal, UFOs, and the title of the book is One Passion Beyond, and I'm very proud of the collection. And in many ways, I don't think there's anything quite like it. And they can receive that for $10 a copy. Check them on the order to Michael Del Russi, P.O. Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey, 7006. And I would be glad to send them not only a copy of my poetry collection, but also a chart, which is very interesting, indicating the wisdom of the hemispheres, both hemispheres of the brain, and symbolically as well as scientifically, metaphysically, what they do and how they guide our lives. That's a laminated chart that I will also send along with the package. So it's, I think, it's certainly worthwhile looking into.
It's definitely worth looking into, and I've read all of this since we began our journey together, and it's really, 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 really helpful and full of light.
Well, thank you so much for that.
And speaking of law of attraction and synchronicity, I was, after our last conversation about this, I got an email out of nowhere from an author who wrote a book about the law of attraction, was wondering if I'd care to like read the book and interview her. So that happened shortly after our conversation where I announced that I'd be launching a show about it.
Well, I'm excited to hear that. And now, is that interview in the future? Is that coming, forthcoming?
That will be coming soon. Right now, I'm realigning all the shows to better to be much more in line with the vision I have for the coming year. But there'll definitely be a bunch of specials on the law of attraction, and if people like it, we'll make it a regular scheduled show. But right now, I'm planning like six specials during the course of the year.
Well, I'll certainly be looking forward to the new programming and projects that you have coming up, that's for sure.
Well, you'll be part of them, so we'll be on this adventure together. And are there any words you'd like to leave people with to think about until the next time we talk?
Yes, I also have a prayer ministry, which I believe in. They can send me their prayer requests, preferably handwritten, to Michael Del Russi, Box 129, Caldwell, New Jersey, 0706, and I will pray over them, put their prayer, their needs and requests in white light. I think that's important. I think that matters, and I will write them back. That's free of charge. I don't charge for doing that, and we will pray and believe for a change in their circumstances, whatever that might be. So that's also part of my ministry and what I do.
Thank you very much, Michael. You're awesome, and I enjoy speaking with you, and I'm glad our paths crossed and we decided to walk this path together. Thank you also to all our wonderful audience members, whether they called in, whether they clicked on a link, or whether they're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you a happy new year, joyous journeys, and amazing adventures. Good night, everybody. And thanks again, Michael.
Blessings to all. Thank you.